Today's program has been brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit internationalculinarycenter.com.
I'm Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb, coming to you live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Julia Tertian. I write about food, and my favorite part about what I do is finding out the stories behind great recipes, restaurants, and more. Every Wednesday, I get to have these conversations on air to bring the pages of Cherry Bomb magazine to life by interviewing some of the most interesting women in the world of food. You can listen to the show live every Wednesday at 2 o'clock on heritageradionetwork.org or download it anytime on iTunes. Today's show is very much in theme with many of the previous shows this season. I'll be talking to three women who are total doers, who not only get things done, they truly get amazing things accomplished. In the first segment, I'll be joined by Jordan Lexton, the founder and executive director of Drive Change, a food truck social enterprise that hires, teaches, and empowers formerly incarcerated youth. And in the second segment, I'll be joined by Laura Manick, a master sommelier who runs Cork Buzz, and the acclaimed chef Missy Robin, who's currently cooking at Cork Buzz. Hi, Jordan. We're going to start with you.
Hi.
How's it going?
Great. I'm really, really happy to be here.
Yeah, I'm so happy you're joining us here today. Before we get into all things Drive Change, I'd love to let listeners know a little bit more about you. Where are you from originally?
I grew up on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, so relatively
local. Stayed
close
to home. Yeah. before starting Drive Change, I know you taught English at Rikers Island for 3 years. Was that your first job out of college?
No, I was a New York City teaching fellow, so I actually taught for 1 year in the South Bronx before deciding to pursue a job teaching on Rikers Island.
So that was your preparation.
Yeah, exactly.
And how did you end up choosing to teach there?
So I graduated from Wesleyan in 2008, and actually there was a theater class that I took my senior year where we taught theater practices and performed productions inside of a training detentional facility Middletown, Connecticut. And it was just a really impactful experience. I was unsure of what I wanted to do post-graduation and had gotten the New York City Teaching Fellows application in my inbox. And I recognized that our commencement speaker was then Senator Barack Obama.
Oh.
And he really talked about like commitment to service, commitment back to the community. And all the pieces fit together. My mom is actually a teacher as well. And I decided that it was really something I wanted to pursue.
That's amazing. And tell us a little bit briefly about the distinction between Rikers, which is a jail, and a prison. You were just talking about this before the show started.
Yeah, Rikers Island is a jail, which means that it's a transitional facility. It's where people spend time, most often 2 years, under 2 years, and most often a year or less. And that time is usually before trial. So while you're waiting to hear what the outcome of your sentence is going to be, whether or not you're going to be convicted of a crime, whether or not you're going to be deemed innocent, and you either cannot afford your bail or you have done something that doesn't allow you to present bail, you are then forced to spend time inside of a jail, which is a holding facility.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And how is it teaching in that kind of atmosphere?
Well, so we have, 8 hours for this show? it's really tangible, meaning that there's an energy that persists. It's a very devastating environment to be in, and especially for the young people that I taught, because I taught 16, 17, and 18-year-olds who were all deemed adults in the criminal justice system. New York is actually one of two states where we automatically set that age at 16. So it really is a very punitive environment. A recent article that was published in the New York Times last Tuesday outlined the real culture of violence and broken system that persists on Rikers Island. And being inside that environment, the sense of hope or potential, what could exist for someone's future, especially when they're so young and already kind of labeled in that position, you feel that every single day. There's a true dehumanization that goes on inside of jails and prisons. And I really believe that it's rooted in an overall broken system.
Yeah, I believe in that article the U.S. attorney was quoted as saying that, especially for adolescent inmates, Rikers Island is just completely broken.
Yeah.
And that was sort of
that was
the
my
long
experience.
And short
of it. I mean, yeah. You know, quite honestly, my experience as well was that the vast majority of the young people I worked with, under different circumstances, with different tools, with different access to opportunity, would be able to harness the potential that existed and rested within them and make decisions to allow them to lead crime-free, very bright futures.
Which leads us a little bit to what you're
Absolutely.
Doing now with Drive Change, because I think you've really tapped into something that is so just proactive and productive. So can you tell everyone, just describe what Drive Change is?
Yeah, sure. That little sentence that is our mission that you started with helps to articulate it. We are a food truck social enterprise. So we use food trucks as a business model and platform to hire and teach and empower young people who are coming home from adult jail and prison. So we provide the actual employment for people. We use the assets of the food truck industry to teach transferable skills. So to be a successful food truck, you need to have a great social media presence. You need to know what your marketing is. You need to have great hospitality. So we use the actual business model of our own business as a way to teach those skills to the young people who are enrolled in our program. And then finally, you know, the reason we wanted to do trucks and not have a storefront, we were inspired by other reentry programs that are food-based, like Homeboy Industries and Grayston Bakery. But being a truck, you have this moment to really get out there in the community. You know, there is no back of house when you're on a food truck. You're there. And that moment of connection is something that we really pride ourselves on, because we're dispelling the preconceived notions that people have when they think of what it means to be formerly incarcerated by sharing meals with people, by having a great service and great food, and also having that moment of social interaction that allows someone to recognize another person as a human being.
Absolutely. Now you're putting a face to...
Absolutely.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, tell us about the steps you took to start the truck, because I know you mentioned you worked with some other reentry programs. You also worked on a food truck, is
yeah,
that
right? Yeah, that's right. So I worked on the Kimchi Taco truck for about 7 months.
In the one here?
Yeah, the one here, okay. Yeah. So I left my teaching job in 2012 with this plan in mind, noticing the recidivism rate for this population being actually around 70%.
Oh, wow.
Recidivism is a word that's used to describe somebody being either rearrested or reincarcerated, re-intercepted back into the system. So nationally, it's about 40% for just the general population. For this young people who are deemed adult population, it's upwards of 70%.
That's quite a statistic.
Yeah. So the inability to find employment, the inability to go back to school, the inability to have social services provided to you really just limit someone's options by way of being able to access that choice, right? Like, I'm going to make a better choice. Well, what if you don't have the options to make that choice? So for me, it became, I need to be a direct conduit to employment and to education for folks. You know, so I took these steps knowing that what I wanted to do was build this food truck social enterprise. And I left my teaching job. I love food. I love eating. I had zero experience working in the food industry. I've been fortunate enough to travel in my own life with my family and taste remarkable food from all over the world. And I believe in the power of food as a tool to really cultivate community. So with that in mind, I knew I needed some experience. So I left and I applied on Craigslist for a job working on the Kimchi Taco truck.
Did they know what your
ambitions were? Yeah, totally.
I
was very transparent with them. And they've been hugely supportive of us and, you know, have like stayed very involved in the work that we do. So, but yeah, I worked there for 7 months. I managed the truck. I learned all of the ins and outs. I figured out I got my own credentials, which is very important and kind of cryptic. So that was a significant journey.
Like Board of Health kind of thing.
Yeah, mobile vendor license, mm-hmm. which is unique and weird in New York City. So learning how to do that so we could teach other people how to do that. And then just gaining the experience and gaining the connections to other food truck owners in the city. Really, really valuable, wonderful community, small business owners, That's really awesome. Hardworking people, and figuring out what the details were that if we were going to really do this, what was it going to look like?
There's so many logistics.
So many.
Like, where do you park that thing?
Exactly, which actually is a huge, huge problem. And we're really trying to work on figuring out a way to develop actually a really functional commissary in New York City that would allow for these small businesses to park, clean, prep, store, and also have access to our training. So we're working now and trying to develop a fundraising plan for that space, because we found that good commissaries in New York for these businesses just don't exist.
Yeah, and the ones that do are really expensive from what
yeah.
I understand.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but the other steps I took was that I decided to also learn from the people who had been working in the reentry space. So I worked for the Center for Employment Opportunities, and I interned also at the Correctional Association. And I got connected to other organizations like the Osborne Association, Getting Out, Staying Out, the Fortune Society, and just folks. I literally just hustled and talked to anyone in that space who would be able to tell us, like, these are the things that are working in our program. These are the areas that we're looking at trying to reform, and this is why. These are what our outcomes are. This is our measurable outcome. This is what we're looking to do. This is our funding source. And we just learned. Yeah. And that was something that, you know, based off of my experience teaching on Rikers, I had an idea instinctually of what I thought was necessary by also listening to my former students tell me what they needed. But I hadn't had the experience of, like, developing, you know, statistical data-driven programs that were going to then elicit the funding streams. So I needed to gain that experience. That was about a year of working in both of those fields.
You did incredible homework.
Yeah, it was necessary. Major. And I credit and thank my parents for allowing me to be able to do that, because they've been, you know, emotionally and also financially very supportive of me in this time. And that's something that, you know, when you think about one's ability to really, like, put themselves fully into something for as passionate and emotional as you can be invested in a social justice issue, if you don't have the resources and support to be able to really do it and leave full-time security and full-time employment, it's unlikely that someone's going to be able to take that next step.
For sure, yeah. No, that's incredible. And I think we're all grateful to your parents for supporting you during this time.
Me too.
What you're doing is amazing.
Me too.
They must be really proud.
They're awesome.
Yeah. Is your mom still helping you cook? I know you mentioned that.
Yeah. So it was definitely, well, so we were developing, you know, well, okay, based off of the experience we've had traveling, all the different foods, I had this one moment where I was actually traveling in Mont-Tremblant, Canada, and had this thing called sugar on snow for the first time, which is just fresh snow with hot maple syrup poured on top. And it creates like a taffy-like substance because of the temperature combinations. And it was mind-blowing. Like, it literally was one of those food moments and instincts where you're just like, this is amazing.
Like, there's an Bourdain oyster.
It, absolutely. Like, yeah. Like, it was just that moment where, like, the whole world went silent, and it was just, it was amazing.
Just you and the snow cone.
Yeah, and it was just beautiful because it's, like, literally two of the most pure ingredients in the world. It's water and, tree. I don't know.
Yeah.
So, and I just recognized that if we were able to take something so pure and then, like, integrate it into this relatively industrial complex, that aesthetically for me is very pleasing. The blend of those two things, but also could tell part of the narrative as well.
Well, it sounds like your strength in all of this is, I mean, you're looking at things that are really complicated. The prison system, like, you know, finding these new opportunities for people, making them, even figuring out how to run a food truck, and you're finding these sort of simple and proactive ways to make it all happen.
It's
amazing.
And it's absolutely an education, and there you only learn from also, like, kind of diving in, and then you make a bunch of mistakes, and you revise and get really smart people to work around you, and it gets a little easier. I mean, you know, so for us, for me, The theme of the first truck was I really wanted it to be French Canadian themed. I really wanted
Snow Day.
Snow Day, yeah. Okay. So Snow Day is the name of the first truck. This experience sort of eliciting that Snow Day moment, but also to the idea that on a snow day there's a liberty that goes along with that. You know,
does that have anything to do with you being a former school teacher?
I was so excited for Snow Day. No, but you know, I think for me, I'm as a former school teacher, I'm also a huge proponent advocate for alternative education. I believe that people learn in different ways and not everyone is suited for an in-classroom experience. And for me, a snow day was always one of those days where you're out there, like you're going to the park, you're involved, you're talking to your neighbors for the first time, somebody's helping you shovel out your car, and there are these moments of education and communication through doing that happen. So that was a real part and tie for me. And then, yeah, you wake up and you have this day ahead of you, right? You can do anything. And that was a big piece. So actually, before the organization was called Drive Change, we're actually a nonprofit for-profit hybrid. So Drive Change is the nonprofit organization that wholly owns the for-profit food truck subsidies. And the food truck, we only have one right now. It's Snow Day, but the intention is to build a fleet of trucks or to affiliate with other businesses.
Do you intend to have multiple snow days or have different?
Different. It could be entirely different based off of, you know, new concepts that come up with us. And if Snow Day goes on to become, you know, successful in its own right, great. But the intention was always to have different brands, different identities, with all proceeds recycling back into the organization. It was actually called the Snow Day Project before the name Drive Change came to fruition. I can't remember the beginning part of this really long-winded answer, but totally. Maple syrup. Yeah.
Okay, speaking of maple syrup and what you can get on the truck, what... Two questions. One, where is the truck? Where can we find it? How do we eat?
That's a great question. So the truck is on Governor's Island all weekend long, Saturday and Sundays, except the third Sunday of every month we're in Prospect Park. And now we're also in Long Island City at the Fauci Building, which is actually run by Jamestown, which is the company that also runs Industry City and Chelsea Market. We're there on Wednesdays for lunch, and then we're in the Brooklyn Navy Yard as well on Thursdays for lunch, and we generally go to Dumbo for like an afternoon
Is the schedule posted on your website?
It is, yeah.
Twitter
is actually the best way to follow us, so at Snow Day Truck is the best way to find the truck. And then the website also has a page called Find Your Snow Day, and that's where we post the locations.
And what about, I know I actually saw you on an episode of Mario Batali's High Road
that's
Show,
right.
which is on Hulu.
Yeah.
And you were the truck that was at the Royal Palms Shuffleboard Club.
Yeah, totally. We don't have a set date with them where we go every week, but we have a good relationship with them, and certainly I think being on Governor's Island for both Saturday and Sunday this weekend has prevented us from being as flexible as we could be, but we'd love to be back in there.
Yeah, but that's a great place to be.
It's a great place
summer,
to be
for
yeah,
sure.
Absolutely.
That's awesome. Okay, so the Twitter handle is
at Snow Day Truck.
Okay. What do you, I have a sort of silly question because what you're doing is really important, but and I don't need to talk about movies, but what do you think of that movie Chef? Did you see
we all
it?
Went together the whole group, yeah. So all of our current class, our pilot class, has 8 young people who are between the ages of 18 and 27, and then there are 3 other sort of executive team members and creative director who's is a consultant for us as well. So we actually all went as a group to see the movie Chef, and we loved it.
Yeah, I thought it was great.
Yeah, it was great. It was a lot of fun. It's maybe doesn't paint the most realistic. We were lucky to be some of the only people in the theater at that time, because there was definitely a lot of like yelling out at the screen, but it was a lot of fun.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's so funny. I want to talk just for a minute before we're about to run out of time, but about the experience of being a customer at the Snow Day truck. And I know it was something you touched on earlier, but how would you explain, what's the experience of patronizing Snow Day versus going to any other food truck?
So we really think about what a customer experience can be. I think in general, people are becoming more socially conscious consumers and recognizing that there's pure market value in the fact that when you eat from our food truck, you are contributing to this reform movement. You are. So you become a part of that community. And we have found that people are seeking food experiences beyond just the food itself. One thing that we recognize is that the food also has to be top.
So whether or not you even know what the social sort of enterprise is, you're still enjoying your experience.
Exactly. Yeah. We want customers to come back again and again and again. And then when and if they do recognize the mission, we want that to just fuel them to be there every day.
Awesome.
But we actually were just nominated for Rookie of the Year for the Vendy Awards as well. Yeah.
In that world, that is like
it's huge.
A major
it's
thing.
The,
yeah, that's
awesome. Oscar.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah. So hopefully we'll be taking that home on September 13th. But
cool.
All of our food is actually sourced, 90% is sourced from upstate New York farms and urban farms as well. And maple syrup is a huge New York State commodity. So we're able to really promote local eating.
That's awesome.
Yeah, we do things like our famous maple grilled cheese sandwich, maple bacon Brussels sprouts, beer battered onion rings with our house pickled veg. So it's very French Canadian in its roots and theme, but the food is really it's really good. And it's all quality
amazing.
Product. But that experience, as you were mentioning, of the person, you know, we've thought a lot about this, right? Like, how in your face do you want to be about what our social initiative is and what our mission is? If somebody's just really coming and wants to have lunch. And we've done it, I think, in a relatively successful, subtle way, like messages on food packaging. We have a TV screen on the truck that communicates the social mission. But we know that there are ways that we can even cultivate even more of an experience for the consumer so that when they are coming to the snow day truck, they feel a part of this community. And we've thought about, like, you know, having people come who are performing in some additional way, like the Theater of the Oppressed groups or groups that are going to do artwork that's related back to either social justice, criminal justice, or other programs as well. How do we create an experience that's beyond just the pure eating experience?
Sure. Even though that is such a great experience. Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome. I think you're doing everything right.
I'm sure we could find some areas.
On that note, we're going to go just quickly because I've run out of time a bit for this segment, but we usually end every segment with a cherry bomb rapid fire Q&A, which are a series of sort of fun questions.
Sounds
no
good.
No pressure. So I'm going to ask you two of them. One, what did you have for breakfast today?
I had a pastel empanada from this awesome Brazilian market in Long Island City.
That sounds pretty great. What's in a pastel empanada?
It was like a chicken little pastry pie.
Great.
It was awesome.
And number two, which is my favorite question, what was your favorite meal when you were growing up?
My mom's matzo ball soup. Absolutely. 100%.
Good answer. Jordan, thank you so much for being here. And thank you most importantly for doing what you do. I'm always inspired to talk to people who not only acknowledge problems, but really find and create solutions. We're going to take a quick break and then we're going to be back with Laura and Missy.
Thank you.
The National Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Hi, and welcome back to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm your host, Julia Tertian. We were just speaking with Jordan from Drive Change, and I think everyone in the room was very impressed and blown away. We're going to turn the microphones over to Laura and Missy. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hey.
Laura, you run Quirk Buzz Wine Studio, which is on East 13th Street, and the newly opened Quirk Buzz Wine Bar in Chelsea Market, which opened, is it 3 weeks ago?
It'll be 3 weeks on Thursday, yeah.
And a third location is coming in January, and you're moving out of New York to...
To Charlotte, North Carolina. Although I don't know if I'm actually crazy to do that after one other opening. So I'm pretending that doesn't exist until December 31st.
That sounds good. So you've had a major year. This is pretty cool. And Missy, you're currently working with Laura on the menu at Quirk Buzz.
I am.
Laura, for anyone who might not know about it, how would you describe Cork Buzz? What do you offer there?
So I started Cork Buzz about 3 years ago to be a wine community of sorts. Well, the focus is wine, but Cork Buzz in Union Square is a wine bar, restaurant. We offer wine classes. We do lots of winemaker dinners and wine events. But it's become slowly like this industry kind of hub, if you will. We do a lot of the Guild of Sommeliers and the Court of Master Sommeliers, just like education there for the industry and for you know, just consumers as well. So Cork Buzz in Chelsea Market is starting off as you know, a really amazing wine bar serving Missy's delicious food. And it was more inspired by like the stand-up, you know, wine bar in Europe where you would just go and eat, you know, small plates and have them paired with wine. So currently we're not doing classes like at this moment, but the idea is more of like a casual, you know, wine tastings and classes come September.
Awesome.
And then just like walk around parties and things that will introduce this large group of people in Chelsea Market to the idea of Cork Buzz and wine.
For sure. No, and I think you've done such a great job of creating this sort of community hub, and even just for the food world, like I hear people say all the time, like, oh, like we'll go after whatever the thing is to Cork Buzz. So it's become
cool.
That like the central perk.
Oh, good.
I'd love to start for listeners with just a few questions for both of you, just about your backgrounds, because you both have pretty amazing backgrounds, and then I want to talk about what you're doing together. So Laura, let's start with you. Where are you from originally?
I grew up in Queens.
In Queens.
Bayside.
Lots of New Yorkers here. And when did you first become interested in wine?
So I took a wine class at Windows on the World in the World Trade Center the July it started of 2001. So I took this class thinking I was going to go to culinary school at CIA, and I was just sort of doing it in between. I just get bored easily, so I had a summer off, and I was like, yeah, I'll do a wine class. That sounds fun. And the first day of class was like maybe July 15th. I just was like, what? How could this be a career? This is amazing. But I was telling Missy earlier in the week, like, I didn't really have the guts to pull the trigger and say, well, I'm not going to go to CIA after semesters, and, you know, dorm rooms are set up and such. So, I just figured I'd just kind of sit on my idea of becoming a sommelier or whatever that meant for a little while. And then, of course, my class, September 10th was our last night. It was Monday night class. So, you know, the whole world changed September 11th. Obviously, I was fortunate that, you know, the only thing I lost, I guess, was the idea of going to culinary school. And I was fortunate to gain, you know, the idea of, well, doing something that you believe in and or you really want to do. And it gave me the, I guess, guts to do that.
Sure. Wow.
So,
that's
so I never went
timing.
To culinary school.
Oh my God. Yeah.
And yeah. And that's and then my first wine job was at Bluefin in Times Square the December.
And how old were
after.
You?
I just turned 21.
Yeah, so we're just able to actually drink.
That's the first time I had a sip, too.
And it's internet radio, so
yeah.
Can be a little flexible. And tell us a little bit more about your time at Bluefin and then with the whole BR restaurant group.
Yeah, well, I started as the sommelier of one restaurant, and then we were getting ready to open, well, Steve, I wasn't, but Steve Hansen was getting ready to open a restaurant in Las Vegas, and so he kind of asked me, well, would you live in Las Vegas for a year and be the opening sommelier of Fiamma at the time with Michael White, Chef Michael White? And so I said, yeah, why not? So I lived for a year in the MGM Grand. And
In the hotel?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. It was really fun. I was rent-free. I sublet my apartment. I, like, just went shopping with all my income. And it was really great. So I did that for a year. I moved back for, like, 2 weeks. And he was getting ready to start a hotel brand called The James. So he's like, hey, you know, that worked out well. Would you move to Arizona and Scottsdale and open my hotel? So I was like the food and beverage director for his hotel when I was like 23.
Oh, wow.
So I went on to be like the opening wine person. So nobody else wanted to like live in a hotel for a year.
Well, it sounds like you're at a moment in your life where that was
no attractive. Commitments, super young, you know, save money and learn a lot. So moved to Arizona. And then after that was Chicago. And so I lived pretty much away from New York working for like 3-4 years. And then my boss at the time, he was a master sommelier. His name is Greg Harrington. He was leaving BR Guest. He was the wine director for all of Steve's restaurants. So he was leaving and he said, you know, I think you would be a really good replacement. So I think that was like right around 25. And I started running all of Steve Hansen's restaurants.
And how many restaurants is that?
At the time, I was like 25.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. So I did that for, I mean, the job itself from 21 for like 9 years.
Wow.
So I left Be Our Guest in 2010, work Harvest in Champagne, and start working on Cork Buzz.
Yeah. And tell us a little bit more, let's back up a second,
okay,
about you becoming a master sommelier.
Oh, yeah.
Tell us, A, what that means for anyone who doesn't know, because it's a pretty big deal.
So. Yeah. So master sommelier is the highest accreditation one can get in the wine world as far as service, especially for restaurants. Master sommelier is when you pass the exam, you've gone through a series of 4 different levels. And the top level is, of course, the master's, which you have for your life. There are currently 20, might be 21 master sommeliers that are women in the world.
Out of how many?
I think we're at 202 worldwide, okay, something like that. We're lucky enough that people pass all the time. So it's like 202 or 201, mm-hmm. I can't recall. But yeah, master sommelier, I passed in 2009, and now I'm on the board of directors for them.
Wow.
And
were you, is it true you were the youngest to ever get the of the youngest?
Yeah, yeah, I mean, it's like this whole, like, I'm not that young anymore, so I like hate talking about this because it's like everybody's favorite topic. But I was one of the youngest, you know, females at the yeah. time when I passed.
My mom always advised me not to brag about being young at any point in my life, because that
then you
last.
Get old. I like to, yeah,
the story gets literally old. Amazing. So that is a title you will always hold.
Yeah.
Wow, that's thankfully. Pretty cool. Missy, you have a similarly impressive background, but in the food world, not the wine world.
Definitely not the wine world.
Where are you from originally?
I'm from Connecticut.
So all East Coasters too.
Yeah.
And when did you first start cooking?
I started cooking my last semester of college. I went to Georgetown in D.C., and I sort of always had this restaurant bug, but never at the time. It was 20-plus years ago, and it was sort of not the thing that you went to do after you graduated Georgetown. So similarly to her, I had to go home and kind of go to my parents and say, I kind of need some help. I want to do this.
Were they supportive of that?
They were amazingly supportive, yeah, and still awesome. Are.
That's great.
Yeah, they think it's like the coolest thing ever. But I also proved to them that I was serious about it, and I worked very hard, and I never kind of like goofed around and got into trouble like can happen in this industry.
Sure, yeah.
yeah, they were always supportive, and I said I'd give it a year. I started my last semester, and then I went away for a summer. I came back, and I said I'd give it a year to see how I liked it, and 20 years later, here I am.
You're still enjoying it. Your career started pretty much in New York under Anne Rosenzweig. Is that accurate?
Yeah. Well, I spent a year and a half in D.C., mm-hmm. and then I came here and went to what was Peter Kump's back in the day. And then,
which is now ICE.
Yes. Right? Yeah. And then I had my first job with Anne. Yeah.
Who's pretty legendary.
She was pretty legendary, yeah. All right.
She still is.
She still is. She was amazing. I mean, she was amazing, a mentor. She still is. Like, we kind of lost contact for many years while I was in Chicago and kind of doing my own thing, and we've reconnected in the past couple of years. We did a tribute dinner for her when Charlotte Druckmann's book came out.
I was very fortunate to
were
be
you
able
there?
To attend
you
that
were there,
day.
Right?
Yeah.
And
it was very special.
Yeah, it was amazing, and it was an amazing group of people I've known for a very long time, and just like being able to kind of make fun of Anne in front of a group was really great too. But Anne had a huge influence on me, not necessarily, you know, your first restaurant job in New York is a big deal and it's scary. And I was a, you know, 24-year-old brat, so to speak. So, you know, she was great. She's a great mentor.
Yeah.
She taught me a lot about business. I worked in the front of house for her too, for a short time at the Lobster Club as well. And then worked at the Lobster Club after that as well.
That's smart. And then after that, you spent time in Northern Italy. Is that right?
Yeah, in between I was at March as well, okay, with Wayne Nish, which was also hugely, hugely, from a fine dining perspective, really what influenced me to want to kind of cook at a higher level. And he was doing something really unique at the time, and it was really my first sort of introduction to tasting menus and really high-end ingredients. And it was a really interesting time at March, too. It was a 50-seat restaurant. It was a very tight-knit kitchen. And then it was time to leave the Lobster Club, and Anne actually helped me go and set me up in my first couple stages, and I spent about five, six months
there.
That's
a great mentor moment. Yeah,
yeah, it was great. I mean, I don't think she was happy that I wanted to leave, but she was she was kind enough that they had enough connections between her and her husband Andy Friedman, who always did her wine for her, that they set me up in these incredible restaurants, and then kind of from there I found my own places, and then I came home.
And Chicago.
No, then I was
okay.
little known secret. I worked at the Soho Grand for 3.5 years, which no one ever talks about. And it was a kind of a unique departure from sort of this fine dining world. And I'd come back from Italy, and I think Italy really opened my mind to being a little bit more adventurous and open-minded to other things. And I interviewed at all these jobs like Felidia and Tocqueville and all these kind of chef-owned small restaurants, which I had been doing for my whole career. And John DeLucy was the chef at the Soho Grand at the time, and he came to me and said, "Why don't you be my sous chef?" And I'm like, "I'm not going to work at a hotel." And then I kind of got offered these other jobs, and I said, "Yeah, maybe I should go talk to John. I've never done anything hip. I've never worked downtown. I've done all this Upper East Side stuff." And I went and talked to him, and John, I don't know if you know John, but he's charming, and I like to call him positively manipulative. And I ended up there, and it was like a very, it was a strange, like, culinary move, because it's hard to work in a hotel. Even back then, I mean, hotels have changed a lot, and most of them are run by great chefs, and there are a lot of restaurants and hotels, but the Soho Grand was in a hotel, and they were very beverage-focused, and I was very food-focused, and it was a challenging time. But from a management perspective, I learned this whole other world of, like, human resources and finances. I had never, ever seen an Excel spreadsheet before, and I rose to be the chef de cuisine there after 3 years. And I always was kind of itching to get out and get back into fine dining, but I kept getting this education. And
that
I would
like
sit
an amazing
in,
education.
Yeah, and I would sit in these meetings with the vice president and the controller, and learn how to go over finances of the whole food and beverage department.
That's so
and
valuable.
So it was really kind of a different part of my education, and I really value it. But it couldn't be a long-term thing for me.
Sure.
So, and also 3 of my best friends came out of that experience, which is also pretty incredible.
That's also awesome.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty incredible, and we're all still really good friends, and everyone's done really well out of there. So it was an interesting time. And then I went to Chicago,
okay.
Which was life-changing.
Yeah.
So
tell us a little bit about Chicago.
Chicago, I got a call from a headhunter one day asking me if I knew what Spiaggia was. And I was like, yeah, I've heard of it. And I think my parents had just eaten there. And they're like, well, they need a chef. Tony Montuano, who I really didn't know very much about, is looking for someone to run the Spiaggia kitchen. And he'd love to talk to you, whatever. So I talked to Tony for 2 hours on a Sunday morning once for the phone. And the story goes that we had so much energy to talk about Italy. And I had eaten at the places that he had staged 20 years before. And there was like this really amazing connection. Mm-hmm. Apparently he got off the phone with his wife, off the phone with me, and turned to his wife and said, "God, I hope she can cook." So I went out there and did a tasting, and I was hired and moved five weeks later. And you know, he said, do you think you can give me 2 years? And I said, I don't know. I mean, I guess so. And it turned out to be 5 years. Wow. And I was just back there this week, actually. And, you know, I still say to this day that I'd probably still be at Spiaggia if it was in New York. Chicago was great, and Spiaggia was great, and I have a lot of family in Chicago. But it just, New York is really home to me, and I wanted to come back, and he was very supportive of that. But Spiaggia was the first time that I cooked Italian food in the States. And it was very intimidating to go in there as the executive chef and have to sort of prove yourself in this cuisine, but also prove yourself in this giant executive chef job of a 4-star restaurant. So it was intimidating, but it just made me work really hard to kind of understand. And Tony is, you know, I don't know if there's anyone more knowledgeable about Italian culture and food than Tony that I know, and more passionate about it. And he really lives an Italian life. He grew up in Wisconsin, but he thinks he's Italian.
That's all right.
He thinks he grew up in Rome, I think. You know, he, again, was an incredible mentor and still is, and I talk to him probably weekly. And, yeah, that was an incredible experience and very hard to leave, and still very hard when I'm there because the whole team is still there. I mean, people...
That's pretty amazing.
And Chris, who's the chef now, who just became the executive chef, I hired him as an extern 6 years ago. So it's pretty incredible to see where these guys have gone and who's still there and who's, you know, the same girls are still making pasta.
It must feel like going home.
It is. It's very... Yeah. We're all sort of like family. It's cool.
But then you came back home to New York, and then you were the executive chef of both of the Avoce restaurants.
Yes, I was.
Was it 2008 to 2013?
Something like that. 5 years.
And while you were there, both restaurants received Michelin stars,
yes.
Which is sort of like the equivalent of the Vendee Award in Jordan's world. And so this all sort of comes full circle to, I was really kind of blown away by your interview you did last week with Grub Street, which is your magazine's food blog. And it was sort of talking mostly about what you've been doing over the past year since you left Avoce. And it made me think a lot about the importance of knowing when and how to step away from something before you start something new, which I think we've all kind of talked about. Or, I mean, you've all talked about today. I've listened. And it sort of reminds me of, it's kind of like knowing the right time to leave a really great party. So tell us a little bit about your decision to leave Avoce.
It was a tough one. It was a really tough decision. And it was sort of coming to a time in my career there where it either was going to be really long term. You know, they wanted to open more restaurants with me. I wasn't sure I wanted to do that. And I didn't necessarily, I mean, there are a lot of reasons why I left, but one of the decisions was I thought it was sort of unfair to them to kind of keep on this path and sort of, once you kind of sign a lease and you open a restaurant and they're doing it for you, you're in it. And I just, there was something in me that didn't feel that way. And, I wanted to really find the right partners, and the Avoce guys were great, and they gave me this amazing platform, and they allowed me to come back to New York and to really make a name for myself, and that was really fantastic. But you know, I sort of looked at it as a longer term decision, and at the time I never intended to take 14 months off. That wasn't like, oh, I'm gonna go take a year off. It sort of was like, I didn't want to look for a job while I was at Avoce. I just didn't have the time. Avoce was all consuming. I was there 6 days a week, and it was just a very consuming place. And I wanted to kind of clear my head. And I said, I'll give myself a year. I never thought I'd last a year, and I never thought I'd enjoy taking time off.
You seem very happy.
Oh, I'm thrilled. Laura's working me like a dog. I am very happy, and I've had a really incredible year, and, you know, everyone, you know, makes eat, pray, love jokes, and it wasn't like that. It was just like I got to live life. Like, sure. When my parents said, do you want to have dinner, I could have dinner. When I hadn't seen a friend in a while or someone came to town and they're like, hey, I'm in town, are you free? I was like, yeah. And I did some traveling. I was in Italy for a month, and I was in Asia for a month last year. And both of those experiences were really incredible. And I also spent a lot of time meeting a lot of people in the industry and talking to people and sort of hashing out who I want to work with and who I don't want to work with and what kind of thing I want to do and what I don't want to do. And that takes a really long time when you've just been in it for 20
sure,
years and you've
yeah.
never actually... I've been fortunate. I got to go from Anne Rosenzweig to Wade Nish, back to Anne, to Tony, to Italy, to Avoce. And I've never kind of stopped to say, hey, what job am I going to seek out? Or I always thought I'd have my own business by the time I was 30. I'm now 43. So, and I still don't have my own business. And that's okay, because I've had an incredible education and an incredible career. And I think it's kind of put things in perspective that it's like not necessarily that important. And when my own business happens, it'll happen, and it'll happen, especially after this last year. And especially even in the last couple months, as I've sort of shifted gears and started working with Laura, you know, what's most important to me is that it's the right business with the right person, with the right partners, with the right amount of money and the right space and the right location. And that I don't want to open a business just to open a business.
Such wonderful
but
advice.
It's taken me 14 months to get to that to yeah. get to that conclusion.
Yeah.
I mean, it really has, and it wasn't like a direct thing, and it wasn't necessarily something I was searching for. It just sort of has happened and evolved after many, many months of meetings and just kind of eating out and hanging mm-hmm. out and traveling and all that stuff. So it's been pretty
yeah.
incredible.
I heard a piece of advice recently, which was you can't figure out when you're someone who's like very much a doer, you can't figure out what you're going to do next while you're already doing whatever it is you're doing. And I think the moment where you really decide to take the time to do the homework to figure things out is so critical and can lead to such good things and good working relationships like the one it seems like you guys are enjoying now.
Oh my God. We love each other. Yeah, we're trying to be calm, but we really like each other.
And, Laura, before you opened Cork Buzz, and you mentioned earlier about taking the time to go spend the harvest season in Champagne, and
yeah.
sort of you had kind of, it sounds like a similar moment of taking this sort of, this moment just to remove yourself from whatever it is you're doing so you can really be prepared for the next thing. So how was that decision for you? Was that something you thought a lot about doing? Or?
Yeah, I always wanted to work at Harvest, and I love Champagne so much. I really wanted to work in Champagne, but some reason restaurants always open in September, which is Harvest in most places in the world. So I never got an opportunity. And similar to Missy, I just said, you know, at some point I looked around and I said, before I started my own business, he's like, listen, you only have one life, and you know, you have to be happy, and you have to do what you really, really, truly believe in. And it wasn't that I didn't believe in Be Our Guest. I just finished a really beautiful chapter at the right time, like you said, like leaving a party at the perfect time. And so I just wanted to take a step back and figure out what exactly I wanted to do. What was my business going to look like? What were the core values that no matter what, even if it was a competitive disadvantage or it meant making less money or whatever, I would just stand for and I would never change. And, you know, living in Champaign in the middle of like France and just picking grapes, like you get a lot of time to think about like what really matters. And it was just like that perfect opportunity to come back like refreshed and rejuvenated and just to start working like a crazy person.
Yeah, no, but good for both of you guys. I mean, it sounds like you really both are taking or have taken the time to really take care of yourselves and put yourself in the right mindset to make good, smart decisions.
Yeah. Not this past month. We just worked like crazy, but other than that, yes.
That's super. We are just about out of time, so I'm going to do the abbreviated cherry bomb rapid fire with both of you. I'm going to ask you the same two questions I asked Jordan. So, Missy, what did you have for breakfast today?
I had a beet juice.
Laura?
Embarrassing. Does breakfast count? Like 10 minutes before I got on the show, I slammed a taco from Dos Tacos in Chelsea Market.
That's a fantastic answer. Yeah, you have a really good neighbor now that you're in Chelsea Market. Their tacos are great. Missy, what was your favorite meal when you were a kid?
Big ziti.
Delicious. What about you?
Yeah, I have a similar. I love the bread salad my grandma made with like mozzarella and tomatoes and then lasagna every Sunday. That's pretty magical.
Great. Both those things.
Yeah, we would have panzanella salad and then like big ziti and
I want to go to
or
your house.
Lasagna.
That sounds
pretty
great.
Amazing.
Lauren, Missy, thank you both so much for being
thank
here
you.
Today. QuirkBuzz is online at it's just quirkbuzz.com. In person, 13 East 13th Street, very easy to remember, or now also inside of Chelsea Market. And Drive Change is online at drivechangenyc.com. And you want to say that?
.org.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's important. And the Twitter handle for the organization is drivechangenyc, and the truck is
Snow Day Truck.
And follow it and go eat maple syrup, everything. As always, thank you everyone for listening. Tune in next Wednesday at 2:00 on Heritage for another episode of Radio Cherry Bomb.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.